So I'll just finish off making a few remarks on these collapse models. Then I'm going to move on to a new topic. So one aspect of these collapse models is that they do make empirical predictions. They disagree with sort of standard unitary Schrodinger equation quantum theory. The first one, which I mentioned already, but is that interference is reduced. Especially for a larger object. So the larger the object is you're trying to interfere, the more interferences you'll lose. And there's an interesting proposal by Roger Penrose that attempts to use that. So here's the idea. We have a photon coming in, and it hits a beam splitter, goes this way or this way. And then if it goes this way, it bounces off a very small mirror, which is on a spring, okay. So attached to some fixed surface. And then the photon goes some distance. It is reflected back. We make it so that these two path lengths are equal. So then the photon is reflected back, and it may come out this way or this way. And we place the detector here. Now, if this mirror were fixed, we can choose the phase so that and these two path lengths are equal. Then, and we just play with the phase a little bit. We can make it so that the photon always comes back out the same way it went in. Okay, so the interference will be destructive here and constructive here. But now consider the case where this this mirror is actually small and it's on the spring. What can happen is, well, either the photon goes this way and comes back, in which case this mirror stays where it is, or the photon goes this way and it hits the mirror and the mirror recoils, so the mirror starts to move in that direction. And now we choose the spring constant and this distance so that they match in such a way that as the photon, by the time the photon comes back, the mirror has gone through half a cycle and returned to its original position. And so if everything is reversible, the photon hitting here should just reverse the evolution, should stop the mirror in its tracks, and then the photon should continue along here. So if everything is reversible, and you set it up appropriately, then you'll see, you'll expect to see interference, and the photon should come out here, and you'll never see any detections here. On the other hand, if there's collapse, if sufficiently big objects collapse, so that this mirror, see this mirror is going to go into a superposition of either staying still when the photon goes this way, or recoiling when the photon goes this way. So it's in a macroscopic superposition of being either still or displaced. So if there's collapse of the sort that I talked about in these models, then then the evolution will not be reversible. You won't have a superposition here, and you'd expect to lose the interference, which means that sometimes the photon could be detected there. So this is, I mean, this is a sort of proposal for an experiment, although it's still a bit too idealized. And if you look at the recall time of these mirrors, then it's typically, you know, a fraction of a second. So this path length would have to be very long. And Penrose suggested putting mirrors on satellites. So the whole thing starts to become a bit unfeasible. But in recent years, people have thought a lot about macroscopic superpositions and quantum nanomechanics, I think it's called. And so it's not completely impossible that an experiment like this will be performed at some point in the future. If this thing collapses rather than remaining in a superposition, then you would lose then everything. So the key reason you get interference is because everything is essentially reversible as you go back. But if this thing collapses, then it's no longer reversible, and so you'd lose the interference. You'd effectively it'd sort of be equivalent to having to knowing that the photon went this way. As you go through the maths, you'll see that. Okay. So that's one sort of empirical prediction. The other kind of empirical prediction is these models seem to give rise to energy production. So if you have an atom, for example, in its like a hydrogen atom in its ground state, then you hit it with one of these jumps. Well, you're multiplying by a Gaussian, and that will change the state afterwards. So it will no longer be exactly in a ground state. It will have some small probability of being excited. And so those excited atoms will decay and produce photons. And so in principle, you could detect those. So that's the second kind of area where you could look for empirical predictions. I think you would hope that error correction would be able to deal with any. So if nature was really described by a class model, you would hope that error correction could deal with this. The reason being that error correction is supposed to be able to deal with just standard decoherence, and this looks very much like that from a mathematical point of view. I don't know if anyone's actually done a careful calculation, but you know, in those error correction models, you're just making certain assumptions about the noise, such that it's local, and I think those assumptions would go through in this kind of model too. Okay.
The second case is actually the violation of the fourth law of thermodynamics. People haven't seen any violations of it.
Well, the effect would be this predicted is very small, and would be quite difficult to detect. If you went to a neutrino laboratory and looked for rare events, then you might start to see it there. But the numbers are chosen so that these effects are very small. But certainly it would violate what is energy conservation it violates. So. Okay, there's a few criticisms of these kinds of models. So I mentioned previously that you always have these tails. So if your jump process is to hit the wave function with a Gaussian or any function which doesn't have compact support, then you will have these tails, and so you'll have something going on so to speak, in the other branches, what you would think of as being the other branches from the many worlds point of view. So there's the problem that maybe you could use the same kind of argument that the many worlds people use to say, well, if this stuff is real, then there's some real stuff happening. You know, there's sort of people living their lives, buildings being built, and everything is happening in these tales. And so why isn't it real? Second criticism is that it's hard to come up with relativistic versions of collapse models. In one sense, that's not surprising that you have this real non-local collapse, and you know, this real non-local collapse happening instantaneously. And so it's difficult to make this really consistent with relativity. And then the third thing is that these models are generally very effective. It would be much nicer if you could derive a model like this from some deeper, more fundamental considerations. So I indicated that perhaps in quantum gravity you would expect something like this to happen. But still, there's no actual derivation of these collapse models from those considerations. In fact, we could speculate if we did have a theory of quantum gravity, and if we believe the sort of Penrose type argument, or the Penrose-Diossi argument I gave you last week, then it seems reasonable that if you take the limit in the direction of where quantum theory is applicable, that you would actually get a collapse model. So it seems reasonable if you had a theory of quantum gravity and you took the limit to where quantum theory is normally applied, that it would give you a collapse model. However, this is not, if this theory could be more fundamental than that theory. And the reason for inventing these collapse models so far has been to solve the measurement problem. If you really want to solve the measurement problem, you should be solving it in the more fundamental theory. The reality problem. Not really here. Whilst if this were true, it would be interesting. This is the place we want to be looking to see what's actually going on. Okay. So before I move on to an entirely new topic, are there any questions? So this is the last of the interpretations I'm going to be discussing. No? Okay. Okay, I'm going to discuss some topics on ontological models. So there's lots of interesting theorems and results concerning ontological models, which give you a lot of insight into how quantum theory is working. I'll start with something simple. So remember I mentioned the density matrix for a qubit Must have been half Pascal. Can be represented by a list of probabilities. Like so. And A here is just a linear function of these numbers. So this is a linear relationship. I also mentioned that the state, if you impose normalization, so these two numbers add up to one, then the probabilities for spin up along these three directions. Must lie on or in this ball. This is just the block ball displaced. So if you were naive, you might look at this and think, well, it's just some kind of probability distribution. And you might imagine, well, perhaps I can model my I can model a qubit like this by having a probability distribution over four ontic states. Okay. Now, obviously, that would be naive because these are actually the x measure. Be a y. The x measurement and the y, these three measurements x, y, and z are incompatible, so they're not a single measurement. But still, it's worth looking at this and seeing if we can model, or seeing how well we can do. So what I'll do is I'll show you first of all a theorem that says that you can never model the behavior of even a qubit or any quantum system with just a finite number of ontic states. Okay. This is a paper I wrote, and the theorem I called it the ontological excess baggage theorem. And then after I've done this, we'll then look and see, well, how well can you do? What part of quantum theory can you get if you allow yourself just a small number of ontic states? So in the case of a qubit, see what you can do with just four ontic states. And we'll see that actually you can get some interesting properties of quantum theory. And you'll be delighted to find out that I'll be using this time four cups. And one orange, not just two cups.
Can you explain the statement a little more? I mean, you are trying to reproduce the density operator?
You're trying to reproduce the predictions of quantum theory with just four ontic states. So I'll show you that that can't be done. Okay. Okay. So I'm going to go through the ontological excess baggage theorem. So here's the idea. You consider L pairs of orthogonal pure states for a qubit or spin half particle. So this can be row 1 and row 2, where L for the, I'm going to call these pairs of states so we have L pairs where small l runs from 0 up to L minus 1. And then we have two orthogonal states labeled by N equals 1 and 2. Okay. And furthermore, they're all going to be distinct, and we can draw them like this. So this, imagine this is the spin. So this one is spin up and this is spin down along some direction. So this is L equals to, this can be L equal to 1 or to 0. This is L equal to 1 and so on. Okay, all the way up to L equals to N. Doesn't really matter. L equal to L minus 1, sorry. Doesn't really matter how far around they go. And we're also going to introduce projection operators along these directions. So I label these projection operators with an O, and we have the same N and L labels. Okay. So clearly, if I perform measurement OML on preparation which has the same L, so this this state corresponds to this projection operator, then I just get this. And also, if I make a measurement along, so if I prepare a state along a different direction and measure along the L direction, then I get a probability which is strictly greater than 0. Okay. So those are the quantum predictions that we need for this result. Now we're going to consider an ontological model. So we have some set of ontic states. And we'll define now some subsets of ontic states. So I want this to be the set of ontic states that can excite the ONL measurement. So the idea is you can orient, you can have your measurement apparatus set with to measure along the projections along the L direction, and then you have n equal to 1, n equal to 2. We're considering one outcome, and then this is the set of ontic states coming in that have some non-zero probability of exciting one of these outcomes. Is that clear? So now we want to define this object, and this is just a set of ontic states which are in the support of this particular quantum state. So if you prepare this state, then this is the list of possible ontic states that could be produced by this preparation. So we can make a number of deductions about these sets of ontic states that follow from the properties, from the predictions of quantum theory. First of all, we know that if we prepare rho n along the L direction, then it's got to give the corresponding outcome. That means that all the ontic states in the support of this quantum state have to also be inside this set of ontic states, the ones associated with the outcome. So we know that has to be true. Is that clear? Yeah. The second prediction, or second thing we can deduce about ontic states, is that well, if we send in a certain state rho n along the L direction, and then we make the measurement om, where m is not equal to n, so n is equal to 1, m is 2, then we know that the probability is 0. That's the first prediction there. So that means that none of these ontic states can excite this measurement, so there can't be any overlap here. So this has to be the empty set. Is that clear? And since we have this result here, where this is a subset of that, we can just put that in here And still, we have to get the empty set. I just need one more deduction. Well, if we, and here m and n can be equal or different. So if we prepare one state and then, along the direction L prime, then we measure along the direction L, well, we know that the probability for that is non-zero. That's the second prediction here. And that means there has to be some overlap in the sets of ontic states. Otherwise, you'd always get probability zero. So this can't be, this overlap cannot be equal to the empty set. OK. So now we can prove that there has to be an infinite number of ontic states. So let's just go through that. So first of all, I'm going to draw a Venn diagram. So let this be the set of ontic states in associated with some L for outcomes where n is equal to 1. And let this be a set of ontic states, same measurement, but where the outcomes are equal to 2. And those sets may overlap in principle. But we know that the set of ontic states associated with the corresponding quantum state has to lie inside here. That's the top property. We have a similar thing over here. Okay. And now we have one more prediction. If we look at the set of ontic states associated with a preparation along the L prime direction, whether n is equal to 1 or 2, we know that it has to overlap with both of these sets. Okay, so it has to overlap, has to at least overlap with both of these sets somehow. It may also overlap with everything else as well, doesn't it? It may even go down here. But the important point is that it has to overlap with both of these two sets. This is one, this is true for m equals 1 or 2. Okay. Any questions at that stage? This is all.
That the ontic state or two different pure states overlap.
So the key thing here is this part isn't important. The important point is that that it has to lie. Just that property. Where is it? There. The ontic state associated with preparation along the L prime direction, where L prime is not equal to L, has to overlap with the outcome sets of states for these two. Well, that may happen as well. It may not. That may or may not happen.
The wave function not real.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. But that isn't something I'm deducing. The important point, the important thing that I need is just that it does at least this. Because if at least that is true, then it follows that we have L distinct pairs . So clearly, because of this property, this set here cannot be equal to this set or this set. It has to be distinct. That means that every pair of sets like this, as we go over L, has to be distinct. Okay. So in particular, we need, in fact, we have two L distinct sets. Now, if you have a finite number of elements in a set, then it's only possible to construct a finite number of distinct sets. Hence, as L, tends to infinity, we need an infinite number of distinct sets. The number of elements in this space has to tend to infinity. Okay. It's impossible to model this behavior in an ontological model with a finite number of states. Okay. So various stronger results have been proven since then. So Alberto Montina proved that you need two n minus two real parameters. In your ontic states, to describe your ontic states. He proved that by making some additional assumptions that go beyond the ontological model, but it's an interesting theorem. And then more recently, PBR, that's Matt Pusey, John Barrett, and Terry Rudolph, proved that that actually the quantum state itself must be part of the ontological state. And so I'm hoping that Matt Pusey will give a talk, give one of the lectures to you this week.
I follow your argument up to the second post, but I cannot follow after that.
If I have a finite set of elements, say any elements, I can label them 1 through 100. Okay. Well, I can only construct a finite number of distinct sets out of that finite set of elements. I can't construct more than, well, you can work out what it is.
Like, if we believe that the wave function itself is a ontic state,
No, but here what I'm doing is I'm trying to model what's happening with a finite number of ontic states, and then showing that actually that doesn't work, that you end up going to an infinite number. Now, if the wave function itself is an ontic state, then of course you would have to have an infinite number of ontic states, because you have this is the wave function, and these numbers are real. Well, they're complex numbers, but they vary continuously. And so you have an infinite number of distinct states. So in a sense, this theorem points in the direction of the wave function being an ontic state. It doesn't prove it, but it points. And also, what's powering this result is exactly that you can prepare very close states and have set up these properties. So this theorem sort of gives you a hint that something like the PBR theorem ought to be true, but it's not a proof of that. Okay. Any more questions? So the next topic is the Speckens toy model. Let's see what happens. So you can read about this on the archive. So it's O. So here's the idea is that you have just four ontic states, like I suggested here. Okay, so 1, 2, 3, 4. And we're going to see how much of quantum theory we can get with a model that only has four ontic states. We know that we won't get all of quantum theory because we've just proven that we need an infinite number of ontic states, but maybe we can get some qualitative features of quantum theory. Okay.
In that particular theorem, like if we only consider the case that L is large but finite,
then you only need a finite number of states. Yeah.
So and we can describe the
Yeah. And indeed, any real experiment, you'd never be able to verify, you know, those properties up to L equals infinity. So certainly, any real data, you would only ever need a finite number of states. You know, I don't know if anyone's ever investigated that from a quantitative point of view. Okay. So the idea of this model is that your states are where you have some what Rob Speckens calls epistemic restriction. So you know something about this. You know something about where the which state the system is in. It can be one of these four states, but you don't know. You don't know everything. So in particular, he defines these six states. The first, where it's either one or two. The second, where it's either three or four. Okay, those are kind of a pair. Then the next pair is either where it's one or three, or two or four. And then the last pair is where it's two or three, or one or four. And you're going to see that these six states are analogous to a restriction on the states for a qubit or a spin half particle. So in particular, this pair of states are analogous in the model to spin up and spin down along the z direction. This pair along the x direction. And this pair along the y direction. So if you draw the block sphere, then really you're just picking out six of the infinite number of possible states. Okay, so z up and z down, x up and x down, y up and y down are the six states that you model out of an infinite number of possible states. Say it again, sir.
Like, how can we see the relationship between the, like, the spin one half system and the four
state? So I'm going to discuss it a bit more. I need to explain how measurement works, and then you'll see how it works. So the other thing you need to do is you need to introduce sort of dynamics and consistency on all this. And I'm not going to go into all the details of how this is done. But this is how measurement works in the model. What you do is you pick out a partition. So you select two pairs. And then you can look and see. So for example, a measurement along the z direction is like this, where you see if the state is here or here. And then you randomize between the two places it can be afterwards. So let me show you how this works using cups and an orange. So we have four cups. Today there could be something up my sleeves. And the cups are labeled 1 through 4. I guess I can do that on the side. Okay. And so you don't know where the orange is originally. So let's just prepare a state. Okay. So initially, we know the preparation I just gave you is an example of the first one corresponding to Z plus. We know the orange is under one of these two cups, but we don't know which one. And we know it's not under either of these two cups. Okay. So now we can make a measurement. We could just measure in the same basis. This is how a measurement works if it's in the same basis. We have to pick up each pair of cups and randomize in those respective pairs. So I'm just going to perform a measurement. Of course, I do know where the orange is. Okay. So let's pretend you don't know where it is. We randomize. So now we don't know where the orange is. It's underneath one of these two cups. And it may be under the same cup it was under before, or it may be under a different cup. Just for the sake of completeness, I should do that as well. Okay. Because last year someone asked a question that necessitated to go back and do that. And so of course, because I could hear the orange, feel the orange when I shook it, I knew that it was under one of these two cups, so that was the answer I got for that measurement. It was under one or two. But I didn't learn, so I don't know where it is. And I know it's not under here. I could instead perform a measurement, so I've got the preparation where it's under one of these two. I could instead perform a preparation, a measurement where I look to see if it's under 2 or 3, or 1 or 4. So then I have to shake. Okay. So now it's still under one. I learned that it was because I could hear it. So the answer, so I got a positive result to that measurement. So it's under one of these two cups. And now I also, just for completeness, I have to randomize these ones too. Okay. So now I've learned that I performed a measurement along the, let's see, what is that? 2, 3 is the Y basis. Okay. And you can see for these, if you restrict yourself to just these measurements, you're going to get the same statistics as you would in quantum theory, sort of obviously. So this model has the same properties as quantum theory, just restricted to those cases. Okay. Now, so Rob actually gives a principle, which I'm not going to write down because it's a lot of words. And this principle tells you what states are possible and what measurements and what transformations are possible. It defines the model. I'll just read it. If one has maximal knowledge, then for every system at every time, the amount of knowledge one possesses about the ontic state at that time must equal the amount of knowledge one lacks. This has to be applied both to the whole system and to every subsystem. So you can imagine not just one toy bit, but you know, 2 or 3 or 4 toy bits. So you can see in this case, I know that it's in one of these two cups and not one of these two cups, but I don't know which one it's in. So there's a kind of balance. And if you look at the paper, you'll see how Rob uses that very carefully to get all the dynamics and all the possible states for the model. I'm going to try and squeeze this model in before I finish today. Mm-hmm. If you have two of these toy bits, so that's one toy bit on the bench just there. If you have two, you can do entanglement. And you can show, according to this knowledge balance principle, that you can prepare states like this. So you have two toy bits. So they could either both be in the one state, or both in the two state, or both in the three state, or both in the four state. And this is analogous to one of the four Bell states. You can also have where it's in the 1, 2, or 2, 3, or 3, 4, or 4, 1. This is analogous to another one of the Bell states. You know what the Bell states are?
Yeah.
Okay. And so on. There's actually four possibilities. And you can show that you can use this to do teleportation. So you have a toy bit coming in. You have an entangled pair over here. You perform a transformation. The result of this measurement is sent over here. You perform a transformation. And the state that comes out at the end is the same as the state that went in. So your state starts like that. And then on the first and second of the toy bits, you perform a measurement into this basis, and you communicate the result over here. And then you can perform a transformation on the last one, and you'll get the same kinds of results you get in quantum teleportation. Of course, restricted to a smaller set of states than is allowed in quantum theory.
I can't imagine how to prepare those states in this grid. We can prepare the state like either one or two.
So imagine I had another four cups. Okay, so I've got four here. Then I had another four cups here. So the Bell state is just where we don't know where. There's now two oranges, or let's say an orange and an apple. So there's an orange under one of these four cups and an apple under one of these four cups. We don't know which it's underneath, but we know that if it's under cup three here, it's under cup three here, and so on. So I don't know how to do that by shaking cups around, but you can imagine like programming some robot to do that for you without telling you what it did. Okay. Okay. So there's a whole bunch of different properties you can get from this model. You can get no cloning. You can get interference type effects. You can get teleportation. You can get dense coding. I'm not sure if you studied this, but this is sort of the converse of teleportation. And there's actually a long list of properties that follow in this model. But one thing you cannot get is contextuality. So I haven't discussed that yet. That's going to be the subject of tomorrow's lecture.